When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The Queen has just paid tribute to Diana, Princess of Wales, in a live broadcast to the nation. She said the princess was an exceptional and gifted woman who inspired others.
There's a possibility here and an extraordinary start because they've got into the lead and that little man has done it again.
In a break with tradition signalling a determination to do things differently, the Blairs walked into Downing Street to be cheered by hundreds of party workers.
There's his cross, it's a deep one, and it's a very deep one to Sheringham, and it's there! Sheringham has made it 1-1!
After a tide of publicity, the new album by the pop group Oasis has at last reached the shops, but for some critics, the launch is as much of a marketing event as a musical one.
Now it's a red card for Didier Deschamps.
Hello everybody and welcome to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard, with Jonathan Wilson and myself. This week is John Bruin, football writer and contributor to The Guardian. John, good to have you back on the pod.
Thanks for having me again.
Now today we're looking at Manchester United beating Juventus 3-2 in the Champions League group stage on the 1st of October 1997. Not that away tie in the semi-final in 99, in the group stage in 1997. Why have you gone for this one, John?
Well, I think Manchester United's rise to become European champions the following season, in fact, the 98-99 season, I would say that their push towards that, well, historic achievement began about this point. If to set the scene a little bit, English teams had only been back in Europe since 1990. English teams in the Champions League or old European Cup had found it exceptionally difficult. It wasn't like now where a English team would go into the Champions League and expect to reach the quarterfinals. And actually, this was the first season, in fact, in which the second place teams from leagues dropped into the competition. So it was a vastly different landscape that you're looking at. And in Juventus were the team to beat in Europe at that time. Of course, they only won one Champions League, which was back in 1996. But they were the team against whom Alex Ferguson definitely measured himself or measured his team. And many of the players of that era have said that as well. And this was a game where they'd played Juventus in the group stage the season before. They'd lost 1-0 over two matches. Now, they were two of the most comprehensive 1-0 defeats you can see because, now, how do we look at this? Now, Juventus at that time were a team full of strong men. Now,
that's very diplomatic.
Yes. And now,
they worked very hard in conditioning, didn't they?
Yes, let's put it that way. And they were a team. I went to the game previously, the season before Juventus came to Old Trafford and won. Actually, that game wasn't so comprehensive because they won with a penalty. And then United, in the second half, having been totally out-muscled, found some belief. Ryan Giggs had a great game. But it was men against boys. And that Ferguson young team of players, the Giggs, Gary Neville, Nicky Butt, Paul Scholes, David Beckham in particular, who had a great game in the game we're about to talk about, or are talking about, they were only 22, 23. They were very young players. And this is about the time that they started to achieve maturity in Europe. And this was a key game for them on that path towards a treble.
I think it's interesting you mentioned the 1-0 in Turin as well, when Alan Boxer scored. And that sort of stands out in my memory is the sort of iconic game of foreigners are a lot cleverer than we are.
Yes.
They understand how to win a game 1-0 and make it totally safe. And it just sort of, men against boys physically, but also mentally. Juve, in that game, just looked a much smarter, tactically more advanced team. To prove you could compete at the highest European level, you had to prove it against them.
Yeah, Marcello Lippi was the manager of Juventus. Now, someone who, I pulled a quote actually from Alex Ferguson's, it's not his first autobiography because he wrote one at Aberdeen, but something that he wrote about Lippi. Lippi is one impressive man. Looking into his eyes is enough to tell you are dealing with someone who's in command of himself and of his professional domain. Those eyes are sometimes burning with seriousness, sometimes twinkling, sometimes warily assessing you, and always they are alive with intelligence. On top of all of his other advantages, he's such a good-looking bastard, he makes most of us look like Bela Lugosi. So there was Alex Ferguson really dishing out praise for someone he was competing against there. So that shows you the level of respect that he had for Juventus.
Yeah. I think, another Ferguson quote then, when you're talking about Juventus being the sort of the big guys and all that, Ferguson said, "I stood in the tunnel before kickoff and the Juventus players made our players look small." And Ferguson, I mean, I remember Manchester United at this time in the 90s when they really got going. They'd won the Premiership, as it was called back then. And they were in European competition. And I think people, unless you were a Man City or a Liverpool fan, generally speaking, I think people would support an English team in European competition, like they would support almost like the national team. Maybe not that far, but I think there was goodwill towards English sides in European competition. Perhaps there's an element of that still, or perhaps that's a bit fanciful, I don't know. But in the 90s, Manchester United, I can remember them being beaten 4-0 by Barcelona and Romario running rings around them. They got a 2-2 at Old Trafford, and it was one hell of an achievement to not lose to one of these big heavyweights. And there did seem to be this glass ceiling for English sides who you could dominate in your own country, win the league, but when you came up against Europe's heavyweights, you, as Jonathan said, they're just that bit more intelligent. They're just that little bit more cannier than us.
And also they had better players. They could afford to buy better players.
Sure.
Zinedine Zidane was a player that they'd bought from Bordeaux a year or so before. And Juventus at this time swapped around strikers. You mentioned Alan Boxic had Christian Vieri. Players like that, neither of those played in this game, but that they were capable of signing players beyond the reach of Manchester United.
Well, even Didier Deschamps, I mean.
Yes, of course.
Obviously, it goes on, or just following somewhere later, to captain France's World Cup winning team. Not a player who would ever kind of, at that stage of his career, a move to England wouldn't have occurred to him.
Yeah, and this was only just in the era when the foreign stars started coming to English football. And one thing you should mention about this Manchester United performance is that it happened without Eric Cantona. Now, Eric Cantona had been the talismanic figure that changed fortunes round at Old Trafford, the type of player they could probably do with right now. And he had left the club. And one of the reasons for his departure was he'd lost love with, he'd fallen out of love with the game. And one of the key moments, I think, in that was United the previous season actually did get to the semi-final of the Champions League. They lost over two legs to Borussia Dortmund, but never really got close to Dortmund. There was a lot of chances created, but they weren't great chances, and Cantona in particular had looked short of his best. And he'd been replaced in the team by Teddy Sheringham, who in this game played a key part, though initially wasn't a particularly successful signing. So this was one of the things about Ferguson that, you know, when we look back at his 26 years at United, is that ability to regenerate a team. And this is one of his greatest challenges. Another player missing from this match, in fact, he'd been injured, I think, the previous Saturday, was Roy Keane. Roy Keane and the Alf Inge Haaland incident had happened just a few days before. If you actually watch the TV broadcast of this, the commentator, the great Brian Moore, mentions the fact that the United were about to issue a statement on how Roy Keane's knee was. Well, as we know, he was out for a season with a cruciate.
Yeah, the incident you talk about is when Keane's injured, not the follow-up incident.
Well, no, yes, it was the first one. It was actually Roy Keane, on both cases, in fact, it was Roy Keane committing a heinous foul that injured someone. In the first instance, it was he injured himself. Mm. But that was where that turf war began, really. Mm-hmm. And so Roy Keane is missing from this team. And so Ronny Johnsen is drafted in to play centre midfield, mm-hmm, and proves himself a very capable player in this match.
Yeah. And at the time, as John has already said, Jonathan, Juventus were the side to beat.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're, I guess, at the tail end of the golden age of Serie A. But they'd, you know, they'd been in the final.
Three times in a row, was it?
At the end of this season will be the third season in a row.
Yeah, so they'd been in the previous two, mm-hmm, two finals, winning one of them. Lippi, yeah, was regarded as probably the best manager in the world.
Yeah.
And you just look at that team. I mean, Del Piero, Zidane, Deschamps, even the centre backs, Montero and Ferraro.
Peruzzi in goal.
Two really hard lads who could play football.
Yeah.
Plus the normal scattering you always seem to get in Italian sides at that time of journeyman Italians who turn out to be really good, like Birindelli and Tacanardi and Pecchia.
Yeah, yeah.
And Inzaghi up front. Not a journeyman at all. But a great goal scorer for all his many faults.
Yeah,
yeah. He just signed for the club, and he'd already developed a reputation for being an intensely selfish player.
Yeah.
You mentioned Montero. Actually, if you watch the game back, Montero gets away with a series of fouls. To the point where Big Ron Atkinson in the commentary box.
That's how far back we're going.
Yes. He said, I'm convinced the referee and Montero must be related. Something that Alex Ferguson afterwards said, that he couldn't believe that the guy had stayed on the pitch. Actually, it was Deschamps that got sent off for a second yellow. One of the things about United's performance is that they started playing at an intensity that Juventus, this powerhouse of a team, couldn't deal with. So they reverted to a type where they decided that they had to stop United by fouling them.
We should also sort of set the context that, mm-hmm, this was when there were six groups of four. Only the group winners were guaranteed to go through, and the two best placed runners up. So whereas now, you know, the two big teams in the group can play each other and it doesn't really matter.
Yeah.
Here, it absolutely mattered that if you lost, suddenly that could be your whole Champions League out the window.
Mm.
And this was the second round of games, wasn't it? United had beaten Košice.
Yes.
And Juve had hammered Feyenoord, I think 5-1.
Yeah, I mean, it turned out that Feyenoord were a bit of a whipping boy in this group, but you didn't know that at the time.
I mean, certainly you expected Feyenoord to be better than Košice.
Yes.
And for them to lose 5-1, you're sort of thinking, Christ, this Juve really are good. So this is the second game, and United probably thinking, at home, we've got to beat them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then what happens in the first minute?
Well, yes, I mean, I was at the game, and, you know, you sit down, or you stand up, actually, European games, at Old Trafford in that era, you stood up all the way through. That was the way it was. I don't imagine it is that way these days in the Europa League. But that was the way that it was, you know. And you see Del Piero cuts from a pass through, scores at the United road end, silence.
Yes, it's Dimash, the left back, plays his low pass towards Inzaghi, who I'm not entirely certain whether he steps over, whether he just misses it. But anyway, it sort of throws a defence. And then Del Piero, it's a brilliant little turn, sits Schmeichel on his arse and he rolls it in.
Yeah.
You're right with the silence. Did you? Was there a feeling of, we're just not up to their level? It was such a sock to the gut, really.
It was, and that's but at the same time, I think a lot of these games, and you still get it now with say Liverpool in the Champions League this year, is that the crowd can play a big part in how a game plays out. You have to say that that evening, United fans got behind the team, even though that goal had been scored.
Yeah,
I mean, at Old Trafford, whenever the team used to score, the opposition scored, United ring out, and it did especially loudly that night. Uh-huh. And the one thing you would say about United is they set off playing as if the score hadn't changed and they were just setting out to win the game. It was the Champions League final, in which in 2019 the sting is taken out of a game instantly by a moment like that, but not in this instant. United kept at it. There was a belief within themselves, possibly because of that game the previous season in which Ryan Giggs had made hay against them, and Alex Ferguson had shifted his team around a bit. The loss of Keane had meant that he'd shifted midfield around. There'd been a three in midfield as opposed to the normal 4-4-2. Ryan Giggs actually was playing through the centre at the start of the game, which previously, the season before that, they played Porto, beating them 4-0. Giggs had played a central role in that game. That appeared to be where Alex Ferguson thought Giggs could do the most damage in Europe. And if you remember Giggs from that era, he was absolutely at his best in those European games against the better opposition. You watch Ryan Giggs on a Saturday afternoon against Derby County, you couldn't be sure that he was going to put in much of a performance. It almost seemed a little bit too easy for him. Those big games against those big opponents, he almost always turned up for them.
Absolutely. All right, we'll talk more about Manchester United 3, Juventus 2 after the break.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. How's your social battery right now? We're nearly at the end of the Premier League season, so I'm pretty drained. So many tense matches, and some not so tense, as well as point deductions, a battle for the title, and teams on the brink of relegation. All that suspense has me needing a well-deserved break. With the year in full swing, it can be easy to get swept up in work, social engagements, even keeping up with all this football, and we can spread ourselves too thin. But with therapy, you can learn to prioritise your time and really recharge your batteries. It's helpful for learning how to set personal boundaries and empowering you to be the best version of yourself, because you should spend your time on your own terms. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/ramble today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, BetterHelp.com/ramble.
Welcome back, everybody, to Greatest Games. So first minute, Manchester United have conceded. But as you say, John, the crowd are thinking, right, come on. We don't want any more of those 1-0 losses again against this lot. And Manchester United, they up the tempo. and they go back on the front foot, and the game starts to play out.
You almost wonder if going behind that early helped them, because there's no sort of, suddenly they're not protecting anything.
Yeah.
So what have we got to lose?
Mm.
I mean, you obviously can go the other way. You can think, oh, Christ, we'll never beat them. But yeah, the sense, watching it back, the sense I got was actually there's a bit of freedom there, that the worst has already happened. We've got to get at them, and that then forces you on the back foot.
Yeah, and I think that Ferguson seems at their apex, and there's other managers like this. Rafa Benitez would be another, that a lot of their best games are where things have gone a little bit wrong, and the shackles have to come off. And Ferguson's teams were always so attacking that it suited them to have to attack, and that once they get back into the game, and even before the goal they scored, the fact that they've got such a foothold in the game means that Juventus are already scrabbling around, and you felt that if they equalised, they could actually go for the win. It became a matter of when rather than if. There was a goal disallowed for Sheringham, which was for offside. And then eventually he scores a goal, and if it is
well,
right.
Well, I wonder if, before we get the goal, I wonder if the substitution they had to make when Nicky Butt had a migraine, did he? Was that the...
Yeah, Nicky Butt suffered from migraines. So, and it was something they thought might affect his career at the time.
So just after half hour, he's forced to go off, and Scholes comes on.
Yeah.
So it's probably the substitution they needed, but you'd never make that substitution in the first half unless you had to. So suddenly the midfield, which had been Butt and Jonsson, with Beckham to the right and Giggs sort of central in front of those three... Suddenly they get a proper creator in the middle.
Yeah.
And that's probably what they needed.
Yeah, and Scholes obviously goes on to score and have a pivotal role, but it was, let's remember, of course, I mean, Paul Scholes went on to play 700 games for Manchester United, but at this point he wasn't quite an established member of the starting 11.
Well, I found it funny seeing him on the bench for that game, because you think in your head, as soon as Paul Scholes started playing football, well, he was legend, started... You know, he was the best player in the team, all that kind of stuff. But yeah, he was on the bench for this game against Juventus, which after that season, you'd think would be criminal to put him on the bench for a big European game.
Well, funny enough, a lot of the games in the season after, Ferguson would favour Nicky Butt and Roy Keane lock it down. I mean, Scholes' breakthrough is a little bit later than people remember, I think.
And I'm one of those people, quite clearly.
Obviously you are, yeah.
Blimey, yeah. So, as you say, Jonathan, Scholes comes on.
Yeah, and then 5 minutes after that, the equaliser comes. And it's a beautiful goal, but a very strange goal.
Hmm.
I'm not sure Ryan Giggs meant that cross.
Well, if he did,
I agree with you.
So, it's Sheringham wins the ball sort of just inside his own half, plays his big, sweeping pass out to the left wing, where Giggs does his Giggs thing of sprinting onto it in a very classical left-sided role for all that he was mainly playing through the middle. And then the cross he puts in is incredibly high and incredibly deep.
Mm.
And if he's seen Sheringham's run, it's quite extraordinary. I suspect he's trying to put it across and he's got underneath it a bit. But anyway, Sheringham comes in. He's got plenty of time because the ball's in the air for so long. And then it's a fantastic header. Downward placed header, but past the keeper and two players on the line.
Juventus would be disappointed they didn't get that off the line, you would think. Maybe.
Well, I prepared to give Sheringham a bit of credit and say enough time to measure the header.
Yeah.
And because he was running onto it, all the pace is already on the ball. Mm-hmm. He's not having to kind of get power from his neck. All he has to do is if that hits the right bit of his head, it's going to have enough pace in it. All he's got to do is place it. And it's such a good downward header.
Mm.
And you often see downward headers are too downward, that they're then bouncing up by the time they get to the line. This one sort of bounces, I don't know, a yard or two in front of the line.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And the two players there, it's sort of an awkward height for them.
Yeah, true.
I was behind the goal when he heads that. And I do remember it like a sort of skidding, they're scrambling around because it felt like he climbed really high to get there. Had to, due to Giggs's whatever it was, cross. one of the things you forget maybe about Teddy Sheringham, because he's always regarded as, this really intelligent player of the ball, is that he was a supreme header of the ball. And he'd learned that probably playing for Millwall alongside Tony Cascarino. But, there was somebody who, in the air, was at Manchester United, of course, in that era, in this game in particular, they caused a lot of problem to a team like Juventus, who are not used to the ball being played in the air. David Beckham played a more central role in this game, but his crossing was excellent and Giggs's crossing was excellent, and they really couldn't deal with it.
Mm. So 1-1, there was a huge wave of optimism around Old Trafford.
Oh, yeah.
And as I said earlier about the sort of that sort of glass ceiling with Manchester United in Europe, I appreciate they did get to the semi-final the season before, so they'd obviously gone deep in the competition. But I always felt that there was still that kind of, oh, we're not quite one of the big boys yet. There's still teams above us, still teams better. And that equaliser, and then obviously the way the game plays out, for me is them almost, for my money, punching through that ceiling.
Yes. Yeah, and that's how it felt. I think the game was still played very much on the nerves because, remember, this is a team featuring a pre-injury Alessandro Del Piero, mm-hmm. You're featuring Zidane, featuring Inzaghi, a very good player in Serie A who maybe didn't know that too much about at the time, but this is a team with a great threat. So the team's living on the nerves a bit, but the way that they were United at their best in that late 90s period, some of the games were sort of frenzied in the way that they ran around and challenged people. And I don't know if Jonathan knows, but I don't know if you call that pressing, but it's of its time, it was.
Yeah, I mean, it's not sort of a structured press as we think of it now, but yeah. it was definitely, there was an energy, a willingness to put the opposition under pressure, not to let them settle.
It wasn't control. It was very English style.
Yeah.
But it wasn't as channeled as you'd perhaps want it to be.
Two of the players that worked hardest in the team would be Giggs and Beckham, who in a previous era, maybe 5-6 years before, would be luxury players in the team that would just expect to receive the ball. Mm. They would chase the ball all night. And that's what happened. And if we go to the goal that puts them ahead, I think...
Well, there's a red card first.
Of course.
So it's a 66 minutes. Deschamps pulls back Ronnie Johnson, gets a second yellow.
But that's almost for an accumulation of Juventus fouls at that point. There's so many fouls have gone in at that point that someone is going to be the fall guy. Deschamps goes, and of course, Deschamps was the master water carrier, as Eric Cantona called him, a supreme controller of midfield, though not in this game. In this game, he'd been overrun.
But those are moments, they're such key moments, because you could quite simply say, two sides going at it, obviously, but the sending off, little wonder Manchester United then went on to win the game. Now, whether that's right or not, the
sending off comes because of United's dominance, it's not the other way around.
Yeah.
I think you often see that.
But also,
the red card can lead to one team dominating, or it can be caused by one team dominating. This was definitely caused by United dominating.
Sure, and also as well, that the Manchester United, they were good enough to sit at the top table in Europe at that time. And they got the shackles off. And whether it was that, okay, obviously Juventus going down to 10 men is preferable, but get the result, get that kind of, get that monkey off your back, do you know what I mean? And they obviously did, and that helped them go on with their belief. And Scholes scores, 3 minutes later?
Yeah, and it's, I think...
That's when they believed, that really turned the tide.
It was, for me personally... I was a Manchester United fan. It was a moment when I thought, hang on, these players can actually do that at this level.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
And this Scholes' finish, I think, is one of my favourite United goals because he's completely unhurried, he's completely calm, he's completely unfussed by the fact that he's going to score this goal against Juventus, probably the best team in the world at the time. And that just showed me that, at that point, that Ferguson's mindset and Ferguson's breeding of these players was coming through. And Paul Scholes, as we said, was a player coming off the bench to do that. But I think Scholes scored some very important goals for Manchester United. The one against Barcelona in 2008 would probably be the most famous of them. But that was the one where I thought, there's a player who embodies Manchester United's belief that they can progress in Europe and beat the teams in Europe. And they kept doing that for quite a long time after. They should have won more European Cups, we know that. But this was a moment where you just thought, they've got it.
Yeah, I watching the game, I totally agree. That was that moment where it was like, oh, bloody hell, they're doing it,
yes.
As you say. And okay, you're right, Jonathan, Manchester United were dominant and Juventus go down 10 men. And they're there for the taking, but you've still got to take them. And I think that...
Well, and the goal, that Scholes goal, it's slightly odd in that there's a sort of just a scramble outside the box and the ball's poked through.
Ronnie Johnson's flick.
Yeah, Ronnie Johnson plays it through. And then... from this chaos, within sort of 5-8 yards of that bit of chaos, there's Scholes, utterly calm, taking it round Puritsi. And one of those, one of those great moments where you think, he's going to score half a second before he scores. Even the biggest pessimist in you thinks there is no way this isn't a goal. Scholes created that calm from from nothing.
Yeah. And then the game carries on. Manchester United, everyone seems to be having a good time in the stands.
Yeah, it was an unbelievable night. And in that time, as I said, those European nights were very, very special when they played those teams like Barcelona, like Juventus, and would continue to be so for a long time until Alex Ferguson left the club. It was always a special occasion. Because they've beaten the team who, they're 2-1 up and Juventus are falling to pieces at this point. The tactical plans of Marcello Lippi are up in smoke and they're scrambling. There's still fouls going in and, United could, and eventually, I suppose, did take them to the cleaners.
Mm.
And it was more of a statement that they didn't just try and hang on.
Yeah.
They went for it even more.
And that Giggs goal, to sort of wrap it up. I know Zidane scores after, but again, like you say, there's a player who epitomised what they're all about on those big European nights. He's full of energy, full of creativity, full of power and all the rest of it. Smashes one in past Peruzzi's near post.
Yeah, and I think if you watch the TV commentary back, you hear a guy on the pitch side mic just shout out, "Go on, Ryan!" which is what everyone in the stadium is shouting as well. Mm. It embodies that moment. And I think at that time, I used to watch United a lot and, say you travel to Europe or whatever, fans in Italy and Spain would talk about Giggs because on those nights, he would be sensational. Mm. I think that's one of those goals that cements his legend as such a good player.
Well, he'd been
Europe.
Brilliant in that 4-0 against Porto, hadn't he? I mean, I sort of, in retrospect, that sort of 4-0 against Porto, okay, it's only Porto, it's not...
With Hilario in goals, living up to
his
name.
Was it Hilario?
Was
it?
Yes.
Okay, that's like Devalli's what I was about to say. But, they're obviously not at the level of a top German team or a top Italian team, but that 4-0 in retrospect was a big sign of, United are on the brink of something here.
I think that's it. You're right. They were always on the brink. And I think that the United fans were great in those European ties, as you say, the giant United, when they go a goal down or lose a goal. But that night for me was when hope turned to belief, if you see what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's strange, really, because if we're to look at the overall picture, this was a season in which United ended up not winning anything.
Well, yeah. That's the odd thing about it.
Yeah. And Alex Ferguson had to go back to the drawing board a little bit. And, I talked before about how there wasn't much team money spent on the team in comparative sense, or not compared to today.
Hmm.
But they had, they went out and they bought Dwight York, Jesper Blomqvist, Jaap Stam, and converted themselves into a team that could compete. And they had Roy Keane back as well. But this was a point where the team showed that it could do without Eric Cantona. It could even do without Roy Keane on certain occasions. And it showed that there was a collective spirit beyond individuals in the team.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they eventually went out of the Champions League that season to Monaco.
Yeah.
Goal scored David Trezeguet at Old Trafford.
5 minutes in, wasn't it? Which had been very similar to the Dortmund game. But okay, that had been 2-0 in aggregate. This was away goals. But the early goal in the second leg at Old Trafford is what kills them.
Yeah, and funny enough, we were watching this game back. A player who had quite a quiet game was Ole Gunnar Solskjaer in this game, who this second season at Manchester United hadn't gone as well as the first.
Got hooked for Phil Neville just after half-time.
Yes, and that summer Spurs put in a bid for him, I think $5.5 million. United accepted the bid and he decided that he didn't want to leave the club that he'd loved so much. And whatever happened to him.
Yeah.
And would United long term have been better?
Yeah. Well, yeah, we can never answer that. But it's interesting because going into that Monaco game, like I say, for me it was like Manchester United should win this. Whereas again, you would sort of think, okay, we've talked about the Porto game, you think, well, they've got a chance. And I remember Ferguson after the game saying, oh, I would have taken 1-0. Because it was 4, and then the second leg just played out 0-0, I think it was.
Mm.
But against these teams like Monaco, like it was against Dortmund the previous year, you'd think, all right, well, maybe they can. Whereas against Monaco, it was like, well, they should. And it was actually a real disappointment.
I mean, to be fair, there was a few injuries about. I think Giggs at that point was missing. And it just, United, having lost Keane, started losing other players as well. They were overtaken in the league by Arsenal at this point. You know, that was a great Arsenal team as well. And I think this is one of the high points of that sort of early Premier League era, is that we start to see two great teams in English football for the first time in the Premier League era, really.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, even 99, it's easy to sort of forget how close things were. That, you know, United end up winning the treble, but if Bergkamp doesn't have his penalty saved in the semi-final, they don't win the FA Cup. You know, Arsenal threw away a little bit of a lead in the league. You know, all manner of things could have gone against them in the Champions League. So in a sense, the luck that went against them at key points in this season, they get back the following season.
But I think also, when I talked before about how difficult it was in the Champions League for English teams, I remember Arsenal qualified for the Champions League that season, and everyone's, there was a certain sense of like, well, they'll show United how it's done in the Champions League. You know, United have struggled in the Champions League, but Arsenal found it even more difficult than United did. But it showed just the step up to Champions League level from the Premier League was so high at that point. Mm-hmm. It really was a huge step up. And this game was one of the greatest leaps I think United took.
Which obviously, as you said, in the next season, they went on to win the whole competition. I mean, in those games, Ferguson would learn quite a lot about this team and tactics. I mean, how do you think with Ferguson, what did he do other than the signings, of course? What do you think were the major difference between, say, that season, the Champions League, and one or two of the previous ones, to the one where they actually won it? The belief was obviously important, as we said.
I mean, I suppose he would sign players. He signed a player like Dwight York. I think Ferguson, in a sense, was lucky with his signings at times. And he'd also had a group of players who played at the very apex that next season. If you think about United's run to the Champions League, how often was the goal scored? It would be a cross from David Beckham, Dwight York header, Manchester United 1-0 up that season. I think York scored 29 goals that season.
Well, the game against Inter, was it?
Yes, and Scholes scored the deciding goal in that. Yeah. Scholes came off the bench in that. So you've actually got something where he's forming a squad. Now, of course, at that time, teams didn't really have squads. They had a first 11, a few other players could drop in and out, but he was forming a sort of collective of a type that I suppose you could probably compare more to Liverpool at the moment now than Manchester City, who have a much bigger squad. I mean, Jonathan knows much more about this than I do. Ferguson is not one of football's great tacticians.
He's certainly not one of the great tactical philosophers. I think he needed a good number two. I mean, I think when Kieros was there, the tactics changed significantly. I mean, yeah, they had this huge problem for a long time of letting in goals at home, which in Europe, really, because of the away goal, really bothered them. So the Dortmund game, the previous season, the Monaco game this season, even this Juve game, were behind after a minute.
Yeah.
And that's a problem that actually goes on. You know, the Barcelona game in the treble season is incredibly open. I can't remember exactly when the goals were scored, but, you know, they conceded three.
It was a deluge.
Well, they had the lead. I mean,
it's a brilliant game, but it's a very open game. And then, you know, this sort of comes to a head with the game in 2000
against Real Madrid,
when they draw 0-0 in Madrid, seem to have done the hard work, and find themselves 3-0 down just after half time. At Old Trafford, and they get it back to 3-2, and actually, on the balance of the game, probably should have won it.
Ryan Giggs amazing again. Yeah,
Karanka should have been sent off for handball on the line, but you know, it's Roy Keane scores a ludicrous own goal. You know, there's a whole series of things went against him in that game. But by being open, they left themselves vulnerable to that kind of thing. There's even in the Deportivo La Coruña game, was it the following season or two seasons later?
2001-2, I think that was.
Two seasons later. And it's after that, when Kieros comes in, that they really change how they approach this kind of game. And rather, you know, the attitude had sort of been, okay, we'll have 20 shots, you can have 6 or 7, and more than not, we'll beat you. But the problem with that is, maybe it finishes 1-1 and that puts you out because of your away goal. Mm. And so it changed, you know, the mentality changes to, you'll have no shots and we'll have 4 or 5 and that's fine.
I mean, I say from a neutral point of view, I was absolutely fine with it. Yeah, well, great entertainment. Well,
I think one of the things is that quite often in these games, and this happened in the Champions League final in 99, is that Ferguson would come up with a master plan and then have to rip it up. And I think one of the things is that his teams were adaptable to those changes. So in this game, Nicky Butt has to go off. He has to the sort of 4-3-3 that he's messed around with, he has to pretty much rip that up and go back to almost like a 4-4-2. In the Champions League final, you know, 18 months later or whatever, he's chosen Giggs off the right and, you know, David Beckham in centre midfield and all this. And he would come up with these complex stratagems, and he actually wasn't very good at them. But it was, he had the ability to change something, and he would make very simple changes in matches where he would say, okay, that guy there is getting joy against our team. You stand in front of him. It was actually quite simplistic. Mm. There was no great, you know, theoretical, you know, treatises about it. It was just, okay, make that change. And that's, I suppose, that's down to the fact that Ferguson had been in the game for so long and had watched so many games that he didn't really feel the need to, I don't know, philosophize in the way that you get so often.
You don't have to philosophize. You know, you can know the game without having one great unifying theory. You can, yes, you can be pragmatic and you can adapt yourself. Yeah, Fabio Capello, you can't say it was one formation and one style of play that suited Capello. He changed on the players he had. If a team that won the title with Roma was incredibly different to the team that he won titles with at Real Madrid or with AC Milan. You know, it's.
But do you think that's a big change in managers, say, of Capello and Ferguson's generation to those now? And it's almost as if you have your Guardiolas, you have your Klopps, maybe Pochettino, not so much, but
they feel they have to have a certain, yeah, maybe. And maybe even it's the fact of having to do a coaching certificate. You actually have to write a dissertation on something, and maybe that by default becomes your set style.
But I think Ferguson would argue that he did that stuff. I think he was the youngest guy to ever qualify in Scotland, and he.
Yeah, but it's different to what you asked to do at Campagnano. Yes. You know, it's I mean, I guess Ancelotti's somebody who is very flexible, although he wrote his dissertation on the 4-3-2-1, which he did use at Milan in his first iteration.
Yeah.
I mean, Ferguson was incredibly flexible.
Yes.
With his tactics, you could say.
But I mean, if you're saying what is Ferguson's strength, it's man management, it's ruthlessness, it's culling people when they've ceased to be useful. But the tactics are, yeah, it's not he's bad at tactics. For all he made certain mistakes with his grand plans in certain key games. But, you know, tactical acuity is pretty low on the list of things he was good at.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, he got them over the line that night anyway.
He did.
And, of course, the next season, as we said, well, they went on to win the treble. John, pleasure talking to you.
Really enjoyed it. Thanks.
Really good. Thank you very much, everybody, for listening to Greatest Games on Football Ramble Daily in association with The Blizzard. For more stories like this, do check out The Blizzard, of course. We're back next week with another cracker from the annals of time from football. We'll see you then.
This was a Stakhanov production.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
Actually, I got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad would say something like that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with something, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.